Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Another day, another crypto lawsuit. And how far people will fly for birds. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, June 6th. Good to have you along. Just one day after suing cryptocurrency trading giant Binance, the Securities and Exchange Commission today sued another company, Coinbase. The crypto exchange is accused of trading cryptocurrencies the SEC says should be registered as securities. The agency accused Binance of, among other things, improperly handling customer funds and trying to attract U.S. customers who aren't allowed to trade on the platform. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports that the cases against both of these companies pose a bit of an existential question for a lot of cryptocurrencies.
The beef between the SEC and these crypto exchanges can be boiled down to one basic disagreement.
The SEC believes that many digital assets are securities.
Zaim Asari is a fellow at the Berkeley Center for Law and Business. Are cryptocurrencies securities like stocks and bonds? Are they commodities like wheat and oil, or just their own thing?
There isn't consensus on this topic.
In fact, different federal agencies have different interpretations, she says, as they go about trying to protect investors and their savings from risk. But the answer to this question of whether cryptocurrencies are securities makes a big difference.
If any of the cryptocurrencies offered by these trading platforms are securities, then the SEC has jurisdiction. If not, the SEC does not have jurisdiction.
But the ripples of these cases go further than that. Ron Geffner is a partner at Sadis and Goldberg.
It's going to have material implications on the viability of the cryptocurrency industry.
Binance may have to completely disengage from the U.S. market, says Jeffrey Blockinger, general counsel for Quadrata Inc. He says Coinbase may face a greater threat.
Coinbase, whose principal customer base is American, in theory, this could have a significant negative impact on them and may even cause them to go out of business.
Coinbase has 108 million customers, according to Reuters, and in March had $130 billion of crypto assets on its books. But beyond the exchanges that trade cryptocurrencies, Blockinger says some cryptocurrencies themselves may not survive being forced to fit neatly into a regulatory framework meant for stocks and bonds and corporations. They don't have boards of directors or annual reports.
It's going to require some work to get these tokens to become issued registered securities, and whether or not it's even possible, I think, remains to be seen.
At a hearing today, Chief Legal Compliance Officer for Robinhood, Dan Gallagher, was asked if cryptocurrencies that were somehow successfully classified as securities could just be traded like stocks through a broker.
It's impossible without regulatory relief and infrastructure changes in the securities markets.
For now, a lot of the regulatory questions around cryptocurrency look like they're going to get worked out through the courts. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Also at the SEC this week, the restaurant chain Cava filed updated paperwork to take the company public. Now, a chain of fast casual Mediterranean-style restaurants becoming publicly traded wouldn't normally be that big news. But right now, there aren't many companies chomping at the bit to make initial public offerings of their shares on stock exchanges. So with a lot of companies waiting on the sidelines, what will it take to make IPOs cool again? Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
People who pay a lot of attention to initial public offerings of stock like to talk about what they call the IPO window. It's open when investors feel spendy, says Sarah Kunst of Clio Capital.
Think of it like when you go on a shopping spree and you buy a bunch of stuff you don't really need because it's fun, right? Versus when you're like really looking at the bills at the end of the month saying, I'm only buying the necessities.
The market's been in that latter category for a while now, Kunst says. So in other words,
right now, the IPO window is pretty shut.
That's a big change from the heady days of 2021 when meme stocks and the blank check companies known as SPACs were all the rage. Then the market corrected.
Unfortunately, it's really hard to have a small correction. You tend to go from things being really, really good to, you know, really not so good.
The IPO window has slammed shut plenty of times before, says Jay Ritter, a professor of finance at the University of Florida.
After the 1987 stock market crash, after the internet bubble burst in 2000, after the 2008 financial crisis.
But unlike during those episodes, this time the stock market is doing relatively well, Ritter says. So why are IPOs so slow? Investors and entrepreneurs still remember the sky-high valuations back in the boom days when the IPO window was open, he says.
It's just like when housing prices fall, people like to anchor on what the price used to be.
Plus, the macroeconomic vibes don't feel right with high interest rates and recession fears, says Santosh Rao at Manhattan Venture Partners.
So I think as things come back to more stability in a sense, I think you'll see the IPO market open up.
The market is also waiting to see how the few planned IPOs like Kava's fare, says Avery Speer with Renaissance Capital. If those companies do well,
that kind of acts as a jam to hold the IPO window open a little bit more.
And if it opens enough, others might be ready to jump through it, too. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, the S&P hit a record high for the year. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the lasting effects of the COVID-19 pandemic is that a lot of people picked up hobbies you can do while alone or while social distancing. Baking, knitting, playing an instrument, but also bird watching. Birding was a multi-billion dollar industry in the U.S. even before the pandemic, and now there's a whole new crop of budding ornithologists. One bird identification app, eBird, saw an almost 60% jump in the number of users over the last few years, with more than 800,000 people logging their sightings. And not only are these new avian enthusiasts buying feeders and binoculars and cameras, some of them are also buying international plane tickets and taking their newfound hobby abroad. One of them, reporter Stan Alcorn, brings us this story.
It started with a bird feeder. But after a month of lockdown in our Oakland neighborhood, my girlfriend and I were carrying binoculars and a paperback bird guide every time we went jogging.
So we stopped our run because we're in a very bird-rich area.
Yeah, we got two sparrows and two pigeons here.
Sparrows, pigeons, crows. But then we traveled from California to Cali, Colombia.
Buenos días a todos y a todos. Bienvenidos.
In one neighborhood stroll with local guide Andres Lozano, I saw
the Colombian chachalaca, black-throated mango.
Jets, ambers.
Plus four kinds of tanager, yellow-bellied seed eaters, chestnut-fronted macaws, 35 species in less than half a mile. And that's normal in Colombia. There are more species of birds here than any other country on Earth, nearly one-fifth of the world's birds. But Colombia doesn't have that many bird watchers, according to local birding pioneer Carlos Mario Wagner.
Una realidad, el país con más especies de aves.
Wagner says when he was growing up, running around in the woods with binoculars was downright dangerous.
Que estaba muy relacionado con grupos armados.
It was something soldiers did for the army, right-wing paramilitaries, and left-wing rebel groups who'd been at war for decades.
A person with binoculars or a camera out in the hills
looks suspicious.
Professor Jorge Maldonado set out to measure the economic potential of bird tourism right as it was becoming safer to get out into wild places. In 2015, when the Colombian government was finally hammering out a peace deal with the largest remaining rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, better known as the FARC.
Now we have the possibilities of access to places that before it was impossible to go.
He estimated a 10-day tour of post-conflict Colombia could attract at least 280,000 birders just from the U.S. and Canada.
If this is going to happen, we are getting $46 million per year.
The Colombian government doesn't count birding tourists specifically, but its annual tally of international visitors in general jumped by a million in the years after the peace deal. Then came the pandemic.
So it was devastating. Now we are recovering again.
One sign of the recovery is the 9th annual Colombia Bird Fair, back in person this year for the first time since the pandemic. I was one among hundreds of international bird nerds. There were workshops, lectures, even a competition to imitate the call of a chestnut-breasted wren. Also in attendance, an American named Molly Brown, invited to help Colombians better promote their birding businesses to a market altered by the pandemic.
There has definitely been a big increase in people who are interested in birds and bird watching.
And Brown thinks that could mean a big increase in birders coming to Colombia, so long as the infrastructure can keep up.
Building up local guides, local conservation initiatives, local protected land, the feelings of security and confidence to travel in Colombia. I think all of those things need to click.
Click. Like the sound of a golden collared mannequin snapping its wings together 60 times a second. In Cali, Colombia, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Coming up,
people were basically paying for certainty.
Can't put a price on it, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 10 points to finish essentially flat at 33,573. The NASDAQ was up by 46 points, a third of a percent, to close at 13,276. And the S&P 500 increased 10 points, a quarter percent, to end at 4283. The World Bank released a new outlook today, estimating that the global economy will grow by just 2.1% this year, a full percent less than 2022. The agency's chief economist said that by the end of next year, a third of the developing world won't be able to meet the per capita income level they had in 2019. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell slightly to 3.68%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. The prestigious James Beard Awards, sort of like the Oscars of the food and restaurant world, were held in Chicago last night. And for the second year in a row, an indigenous chef brought home high honors. Sherry Pocknett, a citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and owner of the Sly Fox Den 2 restaurant in Charlestown, Rhode Island, was named the best chef in the Northeast region. She's part of a growing number of native chefs and restaurateurs bringing indigenous foods to the mainstream and proving there's a market for those cuisines. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more.
Go to any powwow in the Northeast, and Chef Sherry's food stand is the one with the longest line. But anyone will tell you that a Sly Fox bluefish plate or a venison sandwich is worth waiting for. She accepted her award last night in a buckskin dress and wampum jewelry.
I represent the whole Northeast tribes. Our cooking ways. Ooh, this was a surprise.
Full disclosure, I grew up eating Sherry's food, and I can attest that like a lot of seemingly up-and-coming native chefs, she's actually been a treasure in her home community for decades. So why did it take mainstream foodies so long to catch up?
I ask myself that question a lot.
Crystal Wapipaw is a Kickapoo chef. Early in her career, she was warned that people just weren't interested in indigenous ingredients and recipes.
I heard that it's not marketable.
But when she got a chance to open her own restaurant in Oakland, she served Kickapoo food anyway.
Things I grew up on. I grew up on beans, corn, squash, a lot of cornbread.
She says Wapipaw's Kitchen's customer base is growing alongside other indigenous restaurants that have opened since the start of the pandemic in the Twin Cities, Seattle, Oklahoma City.
Hey, it's happening, man. We're rocking.
Loretta Barrett Odin, a Potawatomi chef and food historian, says since she first got started in the 90s, she's seen interest in indigenous cuisines wax and wane.
But this time, by golly, it's sticking.
In part, she says, because social media is driving people to these restaurants. And she says recognition on the biggest night in food can't hurt. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Starting a business is a tough job, even in the best of circumstances. Starting a business when you're new to a country is even harder. And yet, immigrants are more likely than people born in the U.S. to give it a go. The trend holds true even when you break it down by gender. Roughly 11% of immigrant women are entrepreneurs, compared to just 7.5% of U.S.-born women, according to the American Immigration Council. In Houston, where roughly a third of the workforce is foreign-born, Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall visited with some of these entrepreneurs. She caught up with them at a business expo held at a local mosque.
In the carpeted dining rooms of the Dawoodi Bora Mosque in the Houston suburbs, families mill around barefoot, going from booth to booth, where women business owners advertise their bakeries, clothing stores, dental services.
These are Free Spirit roses. These are Pink Floyd roses. These are imported from Ecuador.
Standing in front of boxes of hot pink, mauve, and orange flowers, Umahani Karimji talks about her floral design business, Beginnings by UK.
I started out doing small backdrops for my daughter, Zara.
Birthday parties and that kind of a thing. People started to take notice, asking her to do weddings and other events. Referrals grew within the tight-knit Shia Muslim community.
Actually, I was like, you know what? I think I can do this. I think I can do this as a business.
She opened just as the pandemic hit. The timing allowed her to avoid the setbacks other flower services faced.
I can't imagine having so many weddings booked that year and then just having to close everything down.
She used the downtime to read books and watch tutorials about how to care for fresh flowers. When the pandemic subsided, her business took off.
People just want to celebrate more and more after the lockdown.
Now, Karimji is working 4 events a week from her studio space and managing higher costs.
That same rose that I used to buy, within like a year, it's doubled in price.
One of the things that keeps her going is the memory of her daughter, Zara, who passed away 2 years ago. At the age of 4.
This is something for me that's personally very therapeutic. I feel like she loved flowers so much, so somehow I kind of feel closer to her because she is the inspiration of why I started this.
Originally from Kenya, Karimji is one of more than a million foreign-born female business owners across the country and among dozens at the expo.
This is a labradorite set in sterling silver. And we have
jewelry store owner Tasneem Plummer shows off bracelets and rings with colorful gemstones. At 38, Palmer came to the U.S. from India with her husband and kids and a big dream.
I wanted to explore the jewelry market in the United States.
She worked retail at Macy's first to get a sense of the American jewelry market. But she decided it was time to strike out on her own. She quit Macy's. Then
I was diagnosed of breast cancer.
Even while doing chemo, she kept going to flea markets to sell her jewelry. She remembers her first sale, a sterling silver ring with small emerald for $20. Now, she sells six figures worth of jewelry a year from her store. And she's not stressing about the uncertain economy.
There are still people in the world who still want to buy jewelry.
Also here is Sherabanu Katabi from Karachi, Pakistan. It was her passion for cooking and desire to help her family financially that led her to open Barbecue Village, a nearby restaurant that specializes in kebabs.
My grandma and my mother and my mother-in-law, they are very good chefs.
Katabi learned how to prepare large-scale meals while working for the mosque's community kitchen. The congregation also helped her with seed money.
They give me the good amount of naan without any interest for long periods.
While she says her food is still affordable, she has raised prices a little.
We can change the price a little bit high, but not too much high.
Katabi says in Pakistan, she would never be able to run her own eatery. Restaurant management is traditionally seen as a man's job.
But here, we can do everything, so I can do, and I prove myself I can run the restaurant.
After years of working 7 days a week, Katabi has a better work-life balance now. She has 16 employees, also immigrants, from South Asia and Latin America. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Many people living in densely populated cities, something as simple as parking can become a daily frustration. Looking for a secure location to park for a few hours while shopping or attending a concert or even just going to work ends up costing money and time. But like many others, the parking industry was hit hard by the pandemic. Revenue for folks in that business dropped 56% in 2020. But now, many lots and garages are starting to recover. That's the story for today's My Economy.
I'm Bruce Rowley. I'm in Wichita, Kansas, and I am the co-founder and owner of Best Arena Parking. We stumbled into the event parking business because we bought a building that just happened to be across from a new arena that had just been built to put our marketing business in. And being entrepreneurs, I saw the empty parking lot and I thought, wow, I bet we could sell spaces for that. Obviously, the event parking business was not very great during the pandemic. In fact, it was a complete flatline. But coming out of the pandemic, it's been not just robust, but it's also been transformed by technology. You know, one of the things that I think the pandemic did was get everybody really, really comfortable with paying online and using QR codes and all that kind of stuff. After the pandemic, when we started to see shows again, we started to notice a lot more people asking us if they could book online or if they could pay with their phone. And about that time, we started research and we connected with a company called Park Mobile, and they offered a product where we were able to allow people the opportunity to pay online. At first, I wasn't sure how well that was going to work, but today, and we're not that far into this post-pandemic world, you know, for a big show, we will sell 90 to 100% of our spaces online in advance of the show. What we discovered is, you know, initially we were really selling just convenience. Someone's pulling up at the arena, they don't feel like walking six blocks, so they pay
to park right next door. But what has transformed is when you're buying online, what we found is people were basically paying for certainty. There was a whole new element added into it. You know, they have certainty in terms of I have a ticket, I know I'm going to get into the show, and I probably even have a seat number on the ticket, so I know where I'm going to sit. But now we're able to sell them the certainty of I know where I'm going to park.
That's Bruce Rowley, owner of Best Arena Parking in Wichita, Kansas. This final note on the way out today. Remember back in February when Starbucks got all that attention for putting olive oil in its new coffee drink? Well, not a company to let the buzz die down on the unique combination. Now, Starbucks says it will offer the drinks at more locations across the country. So, if you've been curious about trying the Oleato, about a third of the company-owned Starbucks will have it after this latest push. I, for one, am going to take a pass. Here's your moment of economic context. More on that crypto news we had at the top of the show. Data firm Nansen has been keeping an eye on how that SEC suit against Binance was going to land with investors. Short answer, not well at all. In the 24 hours or so after the announcement, the exchange had a $1.43 billion negative outflow as Binance users rushed to get their crypto assets out of the company. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On Demand, and I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.